something really switched when all of a sudden the way I was spending my time wasn't just in service of myself. You know, when you're a working artist and you go into your studio, you make stuff, and you have to go after opportunities and try and say yes to things, and you have to take risks and all this stuff, but it's all kind of for the service of your own work.
Yeah.
And the work that you do just on your own as an artist. Whereas for me, now that I have an endeavor that really isn't, it is about me in that I have to run this thing and I got to run a business and I got to learn and I don't want to screw it up. But beyond that, I mean, it's much more about galvanizing larger groups of people.
This is The Conversation. It's episode 208 with Steph Halmos. She is a Brooklyn-based artist, and she is also the founder of something called Foreland Catskill, which is a 50,000 square foot historic building in Catskill, New York, a couple hours north of New York City. And she is renovating and developing that building for occupation in 2019, artist studios, art institutions potentially, and more. And you will hear all about that. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. Hello and welcome to 2018. I am being, I think, cautiously optimistic is the tone for the moment, at least for me. I don't know about for you. I will tell you a little bit more about Steph and her project in a moment. First, I want to give you one more reminder that the show that I am in, it's a two-person show with Esau McGee from Chicago at Eastside International. It's opening, depending on when you listen to this, tomorrow night or tonight or yesterday night. Saturday the 13th, whenever you listen to this, hopefully before that opening. It's 7 to 10 p.m. The address is 602 Moulton Avenue. Zip code 90031. Hope to see you there. All right. Would love to see you there. Please come. And so, yes, Steph is an artist who's been working in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and in the process of looking for a communal group studio, long story short, she ended up co-buying a building in Catskill, New York to turn into an artist and art institution, gallery, or nonprofit, and maybe production facilities compound, if you will, communal space, communal commercial space. And that's going to, you know, that's obviously not only changing her life, but changing the community of Catskill. And so we talk about the history of that building, how she collaborates with her father, the co-purchaser of the building, and her contractor, the crew, and so on, what that process is like for an artist and what it's teaching her. On the back end, I am going to give you one more update about the P-word t-shirt, which we could still use some more consumers of to get that going in a second round. And I'm going to share with you highlights from Hyperallergic's 20 Most Powerless People in the Art World, 2017 edition. I'm going to share with you some of the juiciest entries so you don't have to weed through them all. And maybe we can also have a little bit of a monologue slash dialogue about some of those entries. Have a little fun with them. So that's coming up as well. And I think that's about it. Welcome to 2018. Thank you very much for being here. And I'll talk to you more on the back end. So you are
great.
Yes, Steph. You are in. Are you in Greenpoint right now?
No, I'm up in Catskill, New York, about 2 hours north of the city.
Oh, okay. So I guess yeah. we might get into that sooner than later. I'm just going to ask you anyway, since you do live and work in Greenpoint currently. I guess I wanted to know, you know, how long you've been there, what you feel about gentrification in that part of Brooklyn, whether Greenpoint already was gentrified when you moved in, essentially, and that you just became another member of that changed, if you will, community. And obviously this is a relevant thing to bring up based on the project that you are working on upstate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've been in Greenpoint for 12 years, and it's a little bit different than other areas of Brooklyn because it's white on white gentrification because it's primarily and historically a Polish community.
Right.
So it's a little bit different, and I know this will probably make me a bit unpopular, but I don't particularly feel badly or guilty for being part of the changes that have happened in Greenpoint over the last decade. I think it's a great area to live. And I think that though the Polish community has been somewhat squeezed out, they've owned property there for so long, and they still are, for the most part, the landlords. So I think it's a different type of gentrification that I've seen there. And that has really been, I mean, I'm not like way far out on the water in Greenpoint, which has now gone development crazy. So there's like high rises that have gone up and stuff.
Yeah.
That I haven't really seen in my area because I'm a little bit further away from the water where it's really all kind of little row houses type of places.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't particularly feel super conflicted about the way that Greenpoint has changed. I have a general sense of inevitability with Brooklyn, and I just try and do my part to be as engaged in the community as a whole as I can and support as many local businesses as I can. So
yeah.
So it's a little different from like some of the neighborhoods, for example, in South Brooklyn that have gentrified really quickly and are typically like at the, you know, white people moving in at the expense of black and Latino people, you know,
right.
moving out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just a little different somehow.
Well, here's a more maybe slightly personal question. Since you've been there 12 years, have you experienced changes in such a way where you go, oh, the neighborhood's really changing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I remember the first time I was walking down this one kind of major block, but it was pretty desolate, you know, a decade ago. And I remember the first time that a Duane Reade opened.
Mm.
And I was like, oh man, Greenpoint made it. We made it. Like there was never a drugstore. You know, there was never like a Walgreens or Duane Reade or anything.
Right.
And that was a huge, like, I was so shocked by that. And now you just have everything around. So, you know, I think like one thing that I get really sick of generally in Brooklyn is just branding. Like everything is branded in this really kind of clean, hip way. And that's one thing that I really like about some of the old Polish businesses is like the signs are kind of these hand painted signs that are rickety or like kind of like ornate and absurd. And I really like that. Whereas otherwise you walk around and these hyper Brooklyn kind of brandy storefronts are just everywhere. And that kind of starts to irritate me a little bit.
Yeah. When I was in the back before you were there, when I was in the pencil factory studio building, I guess when I would get off, and I'm a little hazy on this because it was a while ago, but I think I got off at the G stop, that's relatively close to there. And right near the subway, there is a big sort of Polish version of Dean DeLuca, you know, was totally not fancy the way Dean DeLuca is, but it was like that type of place that I would go into and get some food and drink maybe and take it with me. And I'm just wondering if you know the place I'm talking about or roughly where that is and if any of that stuff might still be there.
Yeah, no, I can't. It's not ringing a bell the way you've described it. I know that. I used to go to the pencil factory now and again. I didn't have a studio there, but I had friends who were working there, and that was off the Greenpoint Ave G stop. But I don't recall that place that you're referring to. The likelihood is it's not there anymore.
Sure.
A lot of the things that have survived in terms of Polish businesses are the Polish restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, you know, you still can go and get, you know, like a great Polish dish and sauerkraut and all that stuff. Those have survived, but storefronty stuff have primarily been taken over by kind of what you would expect from a hip Brooklyn neighborhood.
Yeah.
But there's also something my experience, I think, is very particular with Greenpoint, because a lot of the older Polish community is Catholic and not really thrilled about gay people for the most part. And as a gay person, I never felt a super warm welcome. So,
how is that manifested? I mean, do you get looks? What kind of situation are we talking about?
Yeah, what kind of looks? Like, you know, you kind of get gawked at a little bit. And I had a landlord when I was in my 20s, and I was living with a girlfriend at the time. And I had a landlord who, he was just generally really inappropriate, but he would make these kind of bizarre comments. And so I think there is a part of me that feels a little like I have a lot less sympathy than maybe I should for the types of changes that I'm seeing in
sure.
Greenpoint specifically.
Right.
Because I feel like I was approached with a decent amount of homophobia, a decade ago. So I probably have a little bit of a chip on my shoulder still left over from that. But, but for the most part, I just love the area. I love the neighborhood. And it's really funny to me that I've lived there all my time in New York, with the exception of a little, you know, little bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you are actually not in Greenpoint currently. You're up in Catskill. And so why don't we talk about this project? I'm not looking at the page right now, but is it Foreland and Catskill or something to that effect?
Mm-hmm. It's called Foreland Catskill.
Foreland Catskill.
That's the name.
And what is Foreland?
Right. That's right.
What does Foreland refer to?
Sure. It's a word meaning a bluff or kind of cliff against a body of water. It's a geographic word.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be the name of the build. It's the name of this building that I've purchased and that I'm working on developing into a contemporary arts building. And that will be the name of the actual building.
Got it. Can I make a comparison that I hope you don't find too jarring? You were just talking about branding in Brooklyn a few moments ago. And as you were describing Foreland as the name of this building that you're working on to eventually rent out, I presume, to artists and whatnot, which we'll get to in a second. But I thought, Foreland, that sounds like a great branding name based on the type of precipice that you were describing.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of, first of all, I didn't say that I'm above branding. I just said that I'm a little tired of it.
Right, of course not. Yeah.
This is hypocrisy at work. No, I mean, this project is going to be a little bit, it needs to be branded because it's a business that I'm going to be running, and there has to be some sort of identity that my business has, but it also has to be somewhat of a blank slate, because when you're developing a building, the whole point is that people can come and they can anchor themselves in that building and not feel like they're kind of oppressed by your style.
Yeah.
You know, like if you, there's been studio buildings I've gone into in Brooklyn when I've been looking for studios or whatever, and you walk in and the landlord or developer, owner, whoever, has painted the walls like bright orange, and there's a chandelier in the hallway. And I just think to myself, in those buildings when I've walked in, I thought, so when friends of mine or you know, colleagues, collectors, art dealers, whoever, comes to my studio and this is the first thing they see, I am immediately associated with that specific aesthetic or taste or choice. And that really frustrates me. So in a way, I have to brand my business, but it also has to be kind of broad enough that other people don't feel like oppressed and kind of squished into my own aesthetic choices.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. I mean,
you understand what I mean?
Yeah, no, I understand what you mean. I mean, I think I was kind of maybe giving you a little bit of a hard time, but when I asked you what Foreland was and you described it, I thought, oh, that's, you know, if that was somehow included in the literature, that would be kind of some pretty hardcore branding. But I think at the same time, in all seriousness, Foreland is a pretty benign, you know, generic sounding type name. And so I think in that sense, yeah, It makes, and just to clarify, well, and wait a second, just let me go back before you go forward. When you mm-hmm. were talking about having studio visits and whatnot, and people sort of associating you and your work with choices, so you're talking about like if you're in XYZ studio building, their experience of coming in and what it looks like in the facade and going down the hallway and all of that, that's going to have like an impact, a pretty significant impact on their perception of your work.
Well, maybe not an impact on the perception of my work or someone else's work, but it's the immediate experience that they're having with where I'm choosing to work.
Yeah.
So I don't think that someone who owns and rents a space to an artist or to whomever should make the types of decisions that are so aesthetically kind of bold and aggressive that it could color a stranger's first experience with work that they might see in that building. I just don't think it's it doesn't sit right with me.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know. It just doesn't sit right with me.
Okay. Yeah, I got you.
But this building is actually a very, very old building that I bought, and it was used, in fact, to make the Union soldiers' uniforms during the Civil War, and so it's been a mill, and it's been a foundry, and it's been all these things. And I had to think a lot about kind of what to call this building. And it is this big, beautiful, tall brick structure that sits on the water. And to me, it is like a cliff.
Right.
It is. Right. I mean, it's certainly a cliff that I'm standing on for my own future.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that was, that was a meaningful, to me, I think it was a meaningful choice.
As you're describing the location of the building, literally sort of being right by the water on the cliff, as I looked at the, you just had the one shot, if I remember right, on your website and for that matter of the building thus far, but it didn't include the water. Was that a conscious choice?
It did not include the water. Is that
correct. I in other words, wouldn't you want like to include? Is it too early? I guess is a better way to ask it, to include like views of the studios from the studios, kind of thing.
Yeah, this project is really in its infancy.
We're at the
very beginning here, and we've got a lot of work ahead.
Yeah,
just even in structural remediation of just keeping this building upright and making it safe and sustainable. And so, a lot of these choices, the images exist on the internet or all that ephemera. That stuff will probably get refined and changed and all that as I go along.
Right.
Because we're a ways out, this is very new and I've got a long road ahead.
Okay. Just in the interest of, I don't know, full disclosure or maybe just being frank, do you think for us to have this conversation now that you are so early is as good a time as any to have it? Or does it feel like maybe if you were to just look at it from an objective perspective that it might make more sense when it was like about to launch or even up and running? I mean, certainly that's not to say that we couldn't have a conversation again once artists are moved in, whenever that is.
Right.
But
right.
You know what I mean? I mean, do you feel like it's, to be fair to both of us, is it all so abstract right now? I mean, what kind of things do you think are interesting at this early phase of the project?
I think that's a really fair question. I think I don't think things are very vague and abstract to the point where having a concrete conversation about it won't be successful or interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly can recognize that, I'm at the very beginning and that we're looking at an 18-month timeline, every bit of 18 months of getting things fixed up and developing this building. The thing that's interesting about it to me is I've learned very quickly, because it took me about 3 years to find this building. I've been working on this project for about 3 years now.
Wow.
And the learning curve really had to do with the fact that I now understand that I'm both capable of being a working artist and I'm capable of being a business person. And I think that is what is the most interesting about this. That and the fact that, you know, I'm learning like crazy. And so to me, I think it's fascinating to stick someone, you know, who's never done this before, someone like me, and stick them with a 50,000 square foot, 150-year-old building and just say, go, you know. So I'm learning at this kind of incredible pace. And I think that where it applies is that I'm starting to see some of the problems of being a working artist and not being encouraged to kind of embrace anything about yourself that isn't just making stuff. So it's not really encouraged for artists to go out and monetize their ideas, for example. I mean, heaven forbid, you know, we talk about the economics of a situation and try and discuss how to earn a living and do what you love, you know?
Yeah.
So no, I don't think it's so vague that there isn't fodder here for a good conversation.
I just want,
I can't get into the specifics of exactly who is going to be in the building or, you know, sort of stuff. But before I even bought the building, I learned how to do a pro forma. I learned how to do sensitivity tests and figure out, oh, okay, so if we have this many studios and we have this many galleries or we have, you know, an event space here or we have a restaurant here or whatever, and I kind of could understand the configuration of the building and how it could function and then start to apply a cost kind of analysis of what that looks like to build out those things and engage people to rent them or take part of it or whatever. I did all that before I even considered buying the building.
Okay.
Just to make sure that I'm understanding, you know, am I going to get myself into some really hot water here? And do I know what I'm doing? Can I do this? Can I make this work?
Let's back up because not to say that that wasn't all, you know, insightful. I feel like for me and listeners, you know, we want to make more of a story out of this. So what was the genesis? You know, what was the seed that started this whole thing? Did you wake up one day and say, I think I'm going to try to get involved in the future of artist studios? Or did you start seeing, you know, were you just kind of sort of haphazardly, you know, looking at ads for your own studio and you saw this building ad? What was it?
So I had been working from home and I was feeling very isolated. And so I decided, okay, I need to go out and rent a studio and be among other human beings.
Right.
So I started to look at spaces to rent all around Brooklyn and Queens, and a few in the city. And I was just shocked by how much money everything cost. And I know that that sounds like a no-brainer. I've been in New York over a decade, but I just was so blown away by not only how much things cost, but how little you get for your money.
Right. Yeah.
Some
it's like
places were just a straight up death trap.
Yeah. It's like, if I could just interject, it's kind of like the studio equivalent of what people have for decades and still go through looking for residential situations. Like, you know, you pay $1,000, you know, or $1,200 and you can have, you know, this little room by an air vent, you know, or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. And in some of these situations I was going in and they were charging $4 a square foot and you don't get a window and there's no security and there's no sprinkler system. So, you know, it's just, I was so disgusted by how artists and just creative people were being just squeezed out and just bled dry. And it just really bothered me and upset me. And I just, you know, thought, I think I could do it better.
Yeah.
I think I could do better than this.
That's where it started. Got it. But raise the question, was there ever, or has there ever been a opportunity to buy one of these places that are being mismanaged or, you know, exploited, or are they just way too expensive?
Oh, they're way too expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're way too expensive. I mean, the truth of the matter is, in Brooklyn, the dirt is more valuable than the building. And so a lot of these people that they own these buildings,
yeah,
they let them go to shit. It doesn't
right.
matter to them.
Right.
And, you know, and then when they sell it, someone else comes in and buys it, and they have spent so much money that they have to hike up the prices just in order to start to make a little bit of a return. And so, you know, artists and our needs can't really compete against the Brooklyn real estate market.
Yeah.
It's just, we're walking around on some of the most valuable dirt in the world, and that's the problem.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, and this is a really important point, and it brings me back to, you know, a few of the conversations I've had with Brooklyn artists and activists, and it really just does feel so futile because the powers that be, you know, especially now with this new tax plan, God forbid that it actually mm-hmm. takes play, you know, it takes hold, but it's just the oligarchy, the rise of the mm-hmm. oligarchy. And so the reason I mention all that is because wouldn't it just in theory be great if you could be somebody changing things from the inside as opposed to essentially being pushed out? And with this, you know, hopefully great building that you're going to eventually start renting out, and it's going to be a great utopia of sorts. We can get there in a bit, but that as opposed to, you know, going 2 hours away to find that you can sort of retool mm-hmm, the situation mm-hmm. where you are.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, part of the reason why it took 3 years to end up where I have is because I really did. I spent a lot of time looking around Brooklyn, Queens, and kind of all the kind of neighboring boroughs there.
Yeah.
And I just found that for what I want to do, I could, yeah, sure. I could maybe try and purchase a building in that area, but I wouldn't end up being any better than any of these other people that were profiting off artists. It was just impossible. It
right.
just was not a possibility.
Right, sure. Well, so, I'm glad you looked into it. I think that's an important thing to do. I was just talking with somebody about consumerism in terms of, like, if you buy these blueberries that are obviously from South America, you know, for really cheap, or you uh-huh. buy these blueberries that are clearly domestic and about 5 to 6 times as much. And it uh-huh. and this person told me that it's ultimately, in terms of the big picture, it's not really about the what's going on the consumer level. It's what's going on in the big picture. And it's uh-huh. and I thought of that because at least you know where you stand, and that's kind of what it feels like is going on with you. You know where you stand. You did your homework as far as the opportunities, and it turned out that there were none in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a real delicate balance because there was this kind of challenge that I had where I had to look at what was happening in the real estate market as a whole, and then I had to look at what was happening to artists working in the city where I'm living and working as well. And it comes down to this idea of sustainability. I
yeah.
can't, you know, everyone that owns these properties and they are involved with providing workspaces to people, they do need to make money. They need to be able to pay their mortgage. They need to be able to maintain the building. They need to be up to code and all that stuff. But at what expense, right? So it's sort of this sort of delicate balance of, like, how do I figure out not to go totally bankrupt and ruin my own life trying to make a sustainable situation for other people? Like, how, where kind of does everybody win? And unfortunately, when it comes to being in Brooklyn and this kind of ownership of these properties, it's just the people that win are just the people that they buy high and rent high. And that's just what's going on right now.
Yeah.
And it's really, really hard to compete against that. Even if we were a possibility of me being able to afford a building in Brooklyn, which I couldn't, it was also sort of like, well, the likelihood is, even if I put in an offer, I'm just going to get scooped by some guy who's got Goldman Sachs backing, and they're just, you know, they're going to take this industrial building and try and work with the city and turn it into loss.
Yeah.
And that's really what was happening. So it was a real delicate balance, and it was a very steep learning curve to try and understand this stuff.
Right.
But I did eventually understand it, you know?
I want to go back to that expression you use, the people that win, you said about a minute ago. And I just wonder, and I know this potentially for you and people listening is going to sound really pedantic, but when I hear people use that kind of word, you know, in relation to either real estate or life, it feels really binary. You know, it's like, here are the people who are winning and the implication is everybody else is losing. Do you see things that way? Or, I mean, was that just a convenient word that you used in that particular context?
No, that was more out of convenience. I'm kind of a, I'm a true blue optimist. So no, I don't think there are quote winners and losers.
Good.
I think it was really more just a convenient word, like you said.
Right. Okay. Good.
But there is a pattern of like the people who have big money are able to buy stuff in Brooklyn, and then the rest of us rent out of the things that they own. And so that really is the real estate market there, you know.
I know I'm being a little pedantic here, but I would call those people maybe the crushers, you know, not the people who win, but the people who crush. You know, they crush the people who are in the buildings that they own, and then they subsequently crush the neighborhoods that they own in.
Yeah, it's really hard. And there were certain times when I was looking at a building that was kind of like out in Brownsville or kind of like deep Brooklyn in that way, where it's, you know, mostly a black neighborhood. And I just thought like, okay, if I buy this like big building here and it's pretty cheap in comparison to Brooklyn, and then I really didn't feel good about being a huge contributor to that.
Sure. Right.
I didn't feel good about it. And so there was, you know, I spent more and more time thinking about it, and then also thinking about what kind of life do I want for myself too? And do I really want to be, you know, sitting around waiting, you know, putting money into this real estate market in this one area of the country just because I've been here a long time, and will it give me the quality of life I want? And and the truth of the matter is, no, it wouldn't.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so I started to consider, what does it look like right outside New York City? What are people doing kind of around here? You've got Dia Beacon, and you've got all this cool stuff that's happening upstate New York. And I started to look around there, and I found all sorts of really wonderful communities, including Catskill, where I ended up buying a building, you know?
So, yeah, and let's just set the stage or the context or the geography, whatever one prefers. Catskill is in the Hudson Valley, which is that technically the region? And it's, are you 2 hours drive north of the city, is it?
Yep, that's right.
Okay. And what is Catskill's proximity to places like Beacon and Hudson and other fairly well-known towns?
It's about 10 minutes from Hudson. It's directly across the Rip Van Winkle Bridge is the name of the bridge.
Right.
And to Beacon, it is it's like an hour north of Beacon, maybe a little less.
Okay, so that's...
And also across the river. So
right.
If you're heading north on the river, it's on the west side.
Right. And I think that's an important distinction to make, just because for people listening, Beacon is sort of an early version of maybe what Catskill will become. You know, it's like a close to the city artist community of sorts, to the extent that Dia has a big outpost there, right? I guess that was like one of the big markers of it. And so you go, as you say, like another hour, maybe less to the north. And of course, Hudson is, I don't know, is Hudson also becoming sort of another north of the city artist community, would you say?
Yeah. Hudson is really kind of a boom town. It's experienced a huge amount of growth, a lot of city money that has come up there, and, you know, people who've bought kind of crumbling houses and turn them into these beautiful places. People who have opened galleries or brought their gallery, a secondary gallery program up there.
Right.
So you have a lot of that going on. And it's a fun town. It's really a cool place. You have all sorts of great food there now. But Catskill, directly across the river, is still quite small in comparison to Hudson, but it's a lot zanier, which I like which I really, really like.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of kookier.
Right, right. Well, before I ask you about what your future looks like in relation to this, because that's obviously a huge question that we've been burying for a long time, but certainly Catskill, for many, brings up the Catskills, which are, is it a mountain range, but also known for Jewish, sort of classic vintage Jewish summer activity, right? And the whole Catskill movement and comedy and so on and so forth. What is Catskill, the town's relation to any of that?
I don't know that I know the village well enough to be an advocate and talk about how the village has functioned historically with that. I wouldn't want to misspeak and misrepresent the village in any way, because I really love it here and I don't want to pretend like I know more than other people, considering I've only been here for, you know, a handful of months now, spending time here.
Sure.
I will say that there's a lot of artists here. There are a lot of people who got priced out of Hudson that are now heading over to Catskill. There's a lot of people who want to buy a house and want to have a really big studio and a lot of freedom and space. And then there's also like people who have been here forever and their families have been here forever and they like to go hunting. And, you know, there's like plenty of kind of like rural community here too. So it's a weird kind of mixture now. I don't really know what it was like. I really can't speak for what it was like in the 1960s through, actually that was even sooner when it was a big like Jewish kind of like, I don't know, family vacation place. So I don't quite know what it was like then.
Well, are you, in other words, are some of those Jewish country clubs or summer camps or whatever one would call them, are they a little outside of the town of Catskill? Are they actually in the town? Do you know where they were by any chance?
Oh yeah, they were outside. So
In the country.
Mountain range is all, you know, Catskill is kind of in, it's nestled right on the water with the mountains kind of behind it.
Okay.
It's nestled right along the river. And so, those kind of like family summer camp type places were more like up in the mountains. Like, I think Dirty Dancing was filmed somewhere around here. And, mostly kind of outside the village up into the mountains.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
So now to get on to, this thing that I think I've been thinking, and I wonder if listeners have been thinking for a long time, and that is, you know, what is your objective here? Are you, once, let's just envision the future in which this building that you bought is fully occupied with artists and designers and what have you. Are you one of them, and are you going to be living up there as well?
Yeah, so, I'm a working artist. My wife is a fashion designer and she produces everything in New York City. So we both have a very long-standing and important connection with the city, but also both of us want a little better of a lifestyle. We both want to have a family someday and we want to give ourselves kind of the opportunity to not struggle quite as much and not have to work so hard and so consistently. So we're slowly making a transition where we spend half of our time in the city and half of our time up in Catskill. And as the project is coming towards a completion and I really need to be there all the time running the business, then we'll live up here full time and kind of be more part time down in the city, you know, for work reasons.
Mm-hmm. So you'll have a house perhaps up in Catskill and then you'll keep the current place that you have in the city, or what exactly is that going to look like?
Yeah. I mean, we're still kind of figuring that out, but ideally we would be able to find a nice house here and be able to have a place to stay in the city when we go. But I'm not exactly sure what that would look like just yet, but you know, in an ideal world, we have a place here. We have a place that we can go to at least weekly there and, you know, make it work.
Right.
So okay. Many people do it. I mean, more and more people that I meet up here. I just met this woman the other day. She was really, really interesting. And she goes into the city 3 days a week
And otherwise, she and her partner live in a house that her partner's father built in the 70s. And she gave us a tour, and it was like this. It just looked like the most incredible 1970s porn set you've ever seen. Just imagine what that looks like. And that is the house.
Wait, the most incredible 1970s what, did you say?
Like a porn set. Like the best.
I thought
porn
you said
set
porn, yeah.
From the 1970s.
So it's total porn, like porn house.
Shag carpet and right, kind of inset floors and, oh my gosh, it was so great. Anyway, she was really interesting, and she does, you know, we were talking to her about how it goes being in the city 3 times a week for work, but living full-time up here. And she just said, you know, it's fine. It's great. It works out really nicely for me. So, you know, we have a lot of models that we can look at for our lives, my wife and I, and try and make this kind of a tangible goal.
Does this woman, those 3 days that she goes down to the gallery to do whatever it is that she does for them, does she have a place that she stays in, or does she just commute down for the day?
She stays for 2 nights, 3 days, and then she comes back, and she has a place she stays, although I don't recall where she said it was, but
yeah.
It seems to work for her, and a lot of people kind of have that set up. Some people just stay with friends, some people have an apartment that they sublet, and so they have a roommate, and they go stay, and they're just there half the time or less, and, you know, everyone kind of configures it different ways.
I guess, you know, I do hear and read, you know, certainly if you look at New York Times Magazine or what have you, or the art section, you'll read about people who have places in the city and then have places somewhere upstate all the time, right? But, I mean, mm-hmm. Are we just talking about a class in which the people that can afford to live in New York inevitably can afford to have a place upstate as well? I mean, we're kind of talking about that level of either income or spending power, aren't we?
Well, I don't think anyone, unless you're really of quite a high class, I don't think anyone comfortably lives in New York. I mean, it's just such a hard place financially to live. So I see what you're saying. How do you stretch your carrying costs every single month to also include being like the town and country, or, you know,
right,
city and country lifestyle? But it's so, for the most part, it's so affordable to live up here or to spend time up here. And so I think that a lot of people, they just give themselves time to find a space that's affordable for them, and they make it work. I think for the most part, that's kind of what people do. Yeah, I'm not sure. For us, we happen to have the house that we're renting right now to spend time in while I do this project. The guy who owns it is incredibly generous and is basically just renting it to us at his cost.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a way that we can figure out how to split our time. Mm-hmm. And that took some time. You know, I had to look around. I had to think about it. I had to do some math and figure out, okay, well, how am I going to keep paying my rent and all that stuff? But it just doesn't increase my monthly costs that much because living up here is so affordable.
Right. When you do put these studios, these 50,000 square foot of studios on the market, do you already know how much rent you're going to be charging per square foot or what have you?
No, I mean, it's, first of all, the whole building won't be all studios. Out of the 50,000 square feet, there'll also be, like there's the first two floors, for example, we're hoping to work with some institutional programming or galleries or what have you, because I really would love this building to also be a public space, not just a private space.
Mm.
And that's where, going back to your question earlier about, like, is it too preliminary to even talk about this? That's kind of like the most I can get into about it right now, because there are still a bunch of question marks.
Mm.
But in terms of like how much we'll charge, I have a ballpark of what it would be, but I don't have them kind of firm yet, because there's still a bunch of outstanding costs that we don't quite know in terms of like, are we going to run into any structural problems or renovation problems? And there are certain big ticket things that, like, you can get hit with these costs and then they really impact the way you use the building.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case here because we basically bought a shell.
Mm-hmm.
It really does vary. And typically with this sort of thing, like if you rent 2,000 square feet, you're going to actually pay less per square foot than someone who only rents 200 square feet. It kind of like you get
sure.
more bang for buck as you scale up. And that's
right.
true for really any studio building.
Right. And that actually raises a good specific question, which is, do you anticipate that for the studios that they will range from as small as 200 to what, like 1,000 or even 1,500 square feet?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess it kind of depends. There's still a lot of, things that I'm going to have to learn. Like I have my kind of ears open to people telling me, you know, we're getting emails more and more about, hey, you know, I'd be interested in renting this much space. Is that something you'd have in your building? And again, like I said, we're still 18 months out and I'm already getting people kind of asking me these types of questions.
Right.
But yeah, we're going to have a pretty wide range of studios. I would love it if there was, you know, if there was like someone who did really big sculptural production or set production or whatever that wanted a really large amount of space. I think that would be really cool. Because the less that I chop up the building, the happier I am. It's really a beautiful building. It's just spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And
yeah.
are you already in conversation with institutions and galleries about, you know, those first two floors you were talking about?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of open to a lot of different dialogue right now. So there are some folks that I'm speaking with that I would love to work with, and I'd rather not get into it on this
I wanted a big picture kind of thing.
Yeah. So there are a handful that I really love. I would like whose programming I personally really love and I think would really be beneficial to the community up in Catskill and in the Hudson Valley region generally. And I hope to bring that to fruition. So I guess time will tell. And as the development starts happening, we'll get a better understanding of that.
Right. Yeah. See, I mean, that's it's an important question because it turns the equation or the perception of what you're doing from you being a business person, you know, trying to create studio opportunities to you being a cultural influencer, you know, that you're making a big imprint on this town with whatever cultural institutions take part in the evolution and the launch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. And I'm sensitive to it, and I have I think a pretty decent understanding of the importance of being.
Ernest?
I don't know, being sensitive to the existing community and to the community that is starting to develop in the region.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a sensitivity to be exercised there, and I'm certainly familiar with it. But also, this building is the biggest building in the village. I mean, it's enormous.
Yeah.
And it's a really important building in the village because it was a mill, and it provided a lot of jobs, and it created a connection between New York City and the Hudson River as, you know, kind of like a big vein between these two elements of a heart as shipping containers or whatever came down the Hudson River and they brought supplies to the city. So having it sit empty is just a shame. It's
right.
really a shame, and it's bad for the economy of the town.
Right. Well, good for you.
Yeah.
So without getting too much into the weeds, which we could so easily do, and I know you're going to be tempted to do so. Just give us sort of an overview of what you're facing in terms of permits, you know, in terms of meeting with contractors and deciding which one you want to go with and so on. I mean, I guess to start it off, maybe a good question would be, do you go through a bunch of permits at this phase and then you have to go through more permits when you're in the midst of development and then you have to go through more permits when everything is done? I mean, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, this is working
Moving to Catskill and working in Catskill is almost the exact opposite of working and living in New York City. Everyone is so excited about the project, and people have welcomed me with such open arms and enthusiasm. And I was so impressed by that and touched. But then, to go a step further, the permitting process has been an absolute breeze.
Wow.
It's just unbelievable. And
that's
so
great.
We've really gotten off on the right foot. And so I feel pretty good about it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like the building inspector, who would be the guy that, you know, double checks that you're going to do what you say you do and that, you know, approves permits. I was kind of shooting the shit with him the other day, and he was talking about how he likes to play in a AC/DC, I think he said, tribute band. I mean, it's just cool. It's just a great environment and a lot of excitement and enthusiasm about these types of projects. So thus far, the permitting process has been kind of a breeze.
Mm-hmm. So when do you anticipate then sort of breaking ground, which is not really the right term, but getting going with the renovation of the building itself?
Well, we already started buttoning up the site. So anything that seemed like it could be hazardous, like if there were bricks that looked like they could fall out and whack someone in the head or broken windows or anything like that, we fixed those all up and we got the site buttoned up. And so really, you know, now we've got an engineer on board, we've got our general contractor, we've got our architects, and everybody's kind of working to get started. So we should, as soon as January, really, you know, be underway.
Wow.
It's a full construction site already.
Right.
We bought it, the closing was on like a Tuesday, and by that Friday, we already had the crew on site.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So is the crew that's on site now, are they going to be essentially some version of that crew going to be on site through the whole process?
Yeah, they are.
And who's your contractor? And who's your contractor?
My contractor is a guy named Rich. His company's called Dimensions North, and I couldn't like him more.
Mm.
Every time I see him, he always says, "Happy Monday, Steph." Or whatever day of the week it is. every single time.
Right.
I just love it. And he helps remind me what day of the week it is too.
just in case, living in New York City, you happen not to be aware of that situation. That's good.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, so
that's awesome. So he's a real sort of
really cool.
He's a real chipper, working class kind of dude.
He is, yeah, and he's really good at what he does, you know?
That's great.
He's no bullshit. He's not going to tell you what you want to hear because it's convenient for him.
Right.
He's not going to take you for a ride. Everyone knows him. Like, you know, I remember I walked around. He just finished a brewery in the village, and I walked around that site before they had opened, and everybody on site was saying, "Oh, hey, Rich, how's it going, Rich?" Oh, you know, checking in with him and happy to see him, and that really matters, because this guy, you know, a lot of the guys that are working on this site, you know, they've got a long road ahead. It's going to be the dead of February, and it's going to be dark early, and they're going to be, you know, out there in this building, on this site, working their ass off, and, you know, it's important to have good momentum and good morale and have a good leader who can, you know, who gives them autonomy to do what they do, because these guys, they can do everything. I'm quite amazed by it. But also who's able to say, okay, you know, this really needs to get done today, or we need to do this and that. And so I feel like I'm in really good hands with Rich, because I'm a novice and he's an expert.
Right.
But he doesn't remind me of that. You know, he doesn't point to that. I'm more often in the one that's saying, you know, Rich, this XYZ has to be your call, because I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And not the other way around. So
yeah.
I really like him so much.
That's great. I'm glad you found such a good contractor.
And
being that the way that the building is going to be distributed in terms of spaces has, you know, is very far from being determined. Does that mean that he and his team are going to be sort of starting with the very structural basics and whatnot of the site and then the building itself that is irrelevant to how the spaces are going to be split up at this point?
Oh,
I'll tell you, Michael, if you decide to bail on the podcast / art making, you'd be one hell of a developer. These are good questions.
Thank you.
These are really good. Yeah, that's exactly right. That is exactly right. You know, the scope of the work is still unclear in terms of use, specific use. So for now, what we need to do is we need to really consider engineering and figure out how to keep this building upright and make it sustainable for another 150 years.
Mm.
And that's a big, that's a really big undertaking because
sure.
a lot of these, for example, the columns that are in the basement of the building that are holding the whole building up, they're wood columns that are from, you know, 1870 something and apparently are each carrying 25 tons of weight. And so imagine like old wood slowly sinking, carrying an entire building on top. So we have to figure out how to incorporate some steel, for example, in the skeleton of the building to alleviate a lot of the weight and pressure that are being put on these old beams. But we're going to, of course, salvage and use everything original as much as humanly possible. So, yeah, engineering first and structural
right.
work first.
Right, right, right. And you're,
yeah.
and just to give me and people a sense of what your role is, since as you made very clear, you are a novice. When you're there, are you? Is it just kind of important to do the FaceTime with your contractor so that you know you're not having these conversations over the phone, and that so maybe he can show you something for your edification? Because it's not like he's kind of saying, this is what we're going to be doing here. It's not like he's going to say to you, should we do X, Y, or Z,
mm-hmm.
Steph,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, there are certain questions that he, you know, that he will come to me with and say, Steph, you know, I was thinking of doing this. How does that sound to you? And again, like he really does let me kind of be the quote, boss
mm-hmm.
when he is at a crossroads and has some options of what to do.
Yeah.
And if I'm comfortable answering, then I just answer. And if I'm not, I say, you know, I'm not comfortable. I don't feel like I know enough about this. So being on site is really important because A, there are going to be certain things that he wants to run by me that I am qualified based on kind of just instinct or common sense to answer.
Mm.
And B, things happen so fast on a site. And so knowing kind of what's been going on and seeing it is a really important aspect of this whole process.
Right. I see.
Mm-hmm.
So now that you've
yeah.
already been in it a little bit so far, are you, whether you have been in the past or not, are you inclined to watch any of these home renovation type shows that are, you know, so omnipresent on cable TV? And streaming services, or are you more likely to say, God, this is the last thing I would ever want to watch?
You get behind some property, brothers. I can't turn down a set of twins using hair products and swinging a hammer. Come on. No, I think over it's really funny because tackling a 50,000 square foot former mill, to me, considering how hard I'm working, seems way more fun than renovating a house. Renovating a house, I don't know why, just sounds like a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's this like certain type of intimacy, the idea of living in it. I'm not quite sure, but something about working in a building, like developing a building to be used as a workspace feels so different than developing a home that
mm-hmm.
you live in. I don't know.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. What about you? Do you watch a lot of those, like the HGTV?
No, I used to watch the God, I'm blanking on the name. Probably this is probably a Freudian thing, but the one where people decide what house they're going to buy and, you know, they have three choices and, you know, and they debate
yeah.
and that, I stopped watching that because it became clear that it was such a false, not that all reality shows aren't, but that it just became such a false facade of what was really going on. But I have seen, speaking of the renovation thing, there's this British
mm-hmm.
one in which some family, like a couple, sometimes with a kid, they will find this property and build a house on it. And the way that they set up the tempo is they have this budget, they get going, you know, things are going along fine. And then it's like, we run out of money. And, you know, it's like, uh-oh, is this thing going to just, you know, are they going to have to give up on this project and refinance or go bankrupt or whatever? And then all of a sudden they cut to, it's done. Oh my God, I don't believe it. It's amazing.
What do you know? It's a miracle.
Yeah, exactly. And these projects, these structures end up being the ones that I've seen, like three of them are pretty amazing actually. So if one were to watch one of these types of things, I would recommend that one. I'm sorry, I don't know the name, but it's on Netflix.
Have you ever seen the movie Money Pit? The Money Pit, that old Tom Hanks movie?
Yeah, I think I didn't ever see the whole thing, but I definitely saw part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, so I rewatched that one recently, and actually it was funny. For Thanksgiving, my father-in-law and my parents and my father-in-law's partner, they all came up to Catskill, and we cooked a Thanksgiving dinner. And my father-in-law is an architect, and so I walked him through the building. I thought it would be interesting for him to see. And then afterwards, he said, "You know, Steph, you know what you should rewatch? You should rewatch that that Money Pit movie. I think it really applies." I was like, "Oh, two strengths a lot, Tom."
Yeah, nice.
Classic.
Was that just sort of like a weird comedic catharsis to watch that movie, or did it have any effect on your thinking of the project at all?
No, it didn't. It didn't bear any real impact. But I did enjoy watching it.
Okay, well that's good.
I hadn't seen it in a long time, and I really enjoyed it.
Would you recommend people watch it though, or is this just something you personally needed to do?
Well, I feel like the Money Pit might be at this point, a cult classic, because it's kind of this, it's such an absurd movie,
right?
And it's really young Tom Hanks, which, right. I mean, come on, unbeatable.
Yeah.
But I think at this point, it's kind of like a cult favorite.
I see. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Like the office space of home renovation movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's exactly
right.
It.
Right.
Got it. Okay. And this building specifically, like this goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier, which is, before even getting into this project, learning how to do some numbers and understand some economics of a building and what it will take to actually use this space is really important, because this is the type of thing that can become a money pit really quickly.
Yeah.
And you could really get into hot water, and then the village is no better off, and you're certainly no better off.
Yeah.
So, you know, my whole life, I didn't think I was very good at math. I mean, I wasn't very good at math, but I thought that I'm not a numbers person. You know, I'm an artist. I don't have any of this savvy or sense. And it turns out that was a complete myth that I was telling myself, just because I didn't do well in geometry in seventh grade or wherever.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Some of those, you know, geometry and calculus and trigonometry, those things, I think a lot of us were probably miserable in, and yet they probably somehow gave a little backbone to our arithmetic and algebra that we probably still use, you know, at least you're using in these situations. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned, I'm glad you brought it back to that. And you also mentioned your family, and you do mention on the description of the building that you and your dad own the building. So I thought we'd be remiss if we didn't mention, like, is he kind of a silent partner, or what is your dynamic like?
My dad is definitely my partner in this endeavor. He gives me, I have autonomy to make decisions. I'm the one that shows up at site. I'm the one that's kind of doing the heavy lifting, but he is my mentor, and he's my kind of, I call him my consigliere. He's like my go-to guy that helped me understand this project. He's done this before. He's renovated old commercial buildings, and he's been in the development world for the last 25 years or something. Not in upstate New York, but in other parts of the country. So yeah, he's the smartest guy I know, and he's really patient with me. And I kind of joke that I got my MFA at CCA, but I got my MBA with him, because over the last 3 years, as we've been trying to find a building together,
you know, it wasn't the sort of thing where I said, I want to buy a building, Dad. And he said, great. I mean, I had to bring him a business plan. I had to understand, like, you know, what this project was, how, like, what kind of financial undertaking it is. And I had to formally kind of present it to him. And he worked with me on it to say, Steph, have you thought of X, Y, Z? Or this doesn't make sense. This doesn't add up. But there's a lot here that I'm learning, and he's really my teacher in it, you know?
Yeah. It seems like it seems like it would be priceless to have a consigliere, as you said, with you when you're a novice starting out in development.
Yeah, I feel really lucky. I feel really, really lucky because not only is this guy so brilliant, just in his own right, but he's also my dad. So I get to I have a reason to you know, learn more about him and what he does and his passion, and he has a reason to learn more about mine, you know, as a working artist and someone who is trying to embrace her entrepreneurial spirit and also continue down a career path that's quite complicated. So it's really cool. I feel really, really lucky, honestly. I do. I kind of can't believe it.
That's great. I'm glad you recognize that. Yeah. Do you talk about the project every day, a couple times a week? How frequent are your meetings of phone or what have you?
Oh yeah. Every single day. There's always something to talk about every single day.
Right. And is simultaneously working on his own renovation projects?
Yeah. He, you know, he has his own business. He's in South Florida. He and my mom live in South Florida and he does all sorts of stuff. I mean, I think like, He's just really involved in the community down there, and he's got a lot more substantial projects that he's working on right now. But he always picks the phone when I call. It's really amazing. So I feel really super duper lucky. I mean, how many people really get to do this? You know,
Totally.
I just feel like this is such a rare opportunity.
Yeah, and I'm thinking too that if your father was even an architect, let alone, you know, like a science teacher or, you know, a curator, a gallerist, you know, whatever, a restaurateur, would you even have the wherewithal, the courage, you know, the brain bank to get into a project like this?
Yeah, I think that's a great, that's a really fair point. And actually for a long time, for most of my life, I just didn't think that I was like him. I thought like, oh, my dad, he's so smart. He's like this brilliant businessman. And then my brother is pretty successful in his own right. And so I kind of always thought, oh, my brother is like my dad and they have this business savvy and I don't have that. And again, this is like a myth that I talked myself into, because it turns out I'm a lot like him, and that I do have kind of a natural talent for this, and I just needed to get over kind of the fear of what it meant for my life and what it meant for the way I'm spending my time and energy. And now that I've gotten past that fear, I just feel so much smarter and more powerful than I ever have before, you know?
Huh, yeah.
And it's just great.
Do you see that manifesting, if not in your art specifically, in your managing your art career, quote unquote? I mean, do you feel like you're more forthright or confident or aggressive in appropriate ways that you wouldn't have been before the project?
I think so. Yeah, I do. And I think that the main, you can probably speak to this. I don't know if you feel this way, but I think something really switched when all of a sudden the way I was spending my time wasn't just in service of myself. You know, like, so when you're a working artist and you go into your studio, you make stuff and you have to go after opportunities and try and say yes to things and you have to take risks and all this stuff. But it's all kind of for the service of your own work and the work that you do just on your own as an artist. Whereas when you, like for me, now that I have an endeavor that really isn't, it is about me in that I have to run this thing and I got to run a business and I got to learn and I don't want to screw it up. But beyond that, I mean, it's much more about galvanizing larger groups of people And therefore, all of a sudden, I have something to offer and I have something to discuss that isn't just about one single person's endeavor. And I think that that has made a really big difference.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that, having this podcast? Because you're also an artist.
Yeah.
But you have something that is about the community, too.
I wish it was as momentous and mind-expanding and selfless, I guess, as you describe. No, I think, if nothing else, to be a little bit more serious, that it's certainly great to have opportunities to get out of the solo headspace, you know, especially
mm-hmm.
When you're working in a studio situation where it's just you. And you have tons of time to make, but also potentially perpetuate negative thoughts, you know, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
In that sense, yes, it's nice to be able to get out of that space and bring a little variety and perspective and so on
mm-hmm.
to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in agreement. And I think that even though it depends on this is so totally dependent on what kind of work you do as an artist. You know, some people, they're really interested in the kind of where art leans towards activism and whatnot. But for me, you know, I'm the type of artist that I just get in my studio and I just do it. I just keep my head down and just make stuff. And that's historically what I've done. And so this is nice because it lets me, it just really has expanded the way that I'm interacting with this art world that I'm kind of part of and have only been part of in one way.
Right.
It's kind of changed my relationship to it and for the better.
Yeah.
And it's also a bit of a relief. I mean, man, this is the first time that I've sat and just had a conversation with someone and it's been so much about me, maybe since grad school. And so I think it's, you know, it less and less often is a conversation about me and what I'm doing. And now it's more and more often about, a community, the idea of a regional building, of historical use, of what do contractors do? How does a planer work? You know, it's just about more interesting stuff than just me sitting around talking about, oh, you know, this is a sculpture I made and this is kind of the thought process.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's more fun. It's a lot more fun.
Yeah. That's great. That's great. But you know, we were talking finally about the fact that you are an artist and you do make sculpture. And one of the things that we talked about in our last call is the fact that you were interning for Annie Leibovitz. And I did just want to bring that up before we get too far into things and run out of time because you are a sculptor and you were working for a photographer. And I just wonder if that's something that changed, that you went from being a photographer to being a sculptor, or you still consider yourself partially a photographer, what that internship was about at the time?
So I for years and years primarily made photographs and videos pretty much for my whole 20s, all of my 20s and my young years in New York, and then throughout graduate school. So working for Annie Leibovitz, I was really young, and at the time I was kind of trying to figure out, like, how do I make and show photographs in the kind of more fine art context, but maybe put a little money in my pocket by taking on commercial jobs or commercial assisting jobs. That's really what I did in my early 20s, and that's how I paid my rent. So, and then, you know, years later, it's kind of a fluke accident that I ended up making 3D objects. It's just a bizarre turn of series of events that have led me here.
None of which are really anecdotably reproducible.
Anecdotably reproducible. meaning, Steph, why are you being vague?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, in other words, is this too long a story to get into?
No, it isn't. I mentioned it on the last time we spoke, which is that after grad school, I moved back to New York from San Francisco. I packed up all my stuff in one of those U-Haul boxes, you know, you pack it into a box and they kind of ship it out here.
Mm.
And at the time, I was still trying to find an apartment and my box was supposed to be stored in Harlem, but instead they had moved it and not told me and they had stored it in Chelsea. And then Superstorm Sandy hit, and I lost all my stuff. So all my stuff got drowned in the Hudson River, everything I ever made.
Oh, my God.
And it was really brutal. It was just
That's
awful.
Horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible. It was a really horrible time and just, man. And I've never felt so kind of insignificant, and the work I make has never felt so meaningless as when I opened up that box and all this mold and water came flooding out and everything was ruined. But for two or so years, I didn't make anything at all. Probably like 2.5 years, I didn't make a single thing. And then all of a sudden, I started to make stuff again, and they were all sculptures. And I don't quite know what happened. Maybe just that feeling of moving around this like wrinkled, shredded paper of these big, beautiful photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I don't know. Maybe my body just viscerally thought, no, we got to make sturdier things now. Or maybe I'm just not thinking photographically anymore. I'm so sick of looking at pictures, you know,
mm-hmm.
Generally. So I'm not sure what it was, but there's the anecdote for you.
That's beautiful. I think it would have been absolutely a shame if we had not talked about that. What did you do for those 2 years? How would you describe those two plus years?
Misery, really. I mean, just awful. You know, in New York, so much of your self-worth is wrapped up in what you do,
yeah.
Right? So that's like one of the first questions that we ask each other, like, oh, hey, what do you do? And therefore, you know, I had a really hard time. I really struggled because I didn't know how to answer the question, what do I do? Because I wasn't doing anything. I just couldn't make anything. I just suffered, you know, just a horrible block, for lack of a better term, you know?
Yeah.
I wasn't working. I wasn't making anything. I wasn't, my creative output, not only was stalled, but had come to a dead halt, a screeching halt. And, I was trying to figure out how to make money. And I just was struggling. I just had a horrible 2 years, and things definitely turned around when I met the person who would become my wife. But yeah, it was misery. All I did was kind of take on random little freelance jobs and other things like that. And, I don't know. And I would go into my studio and I'd stare at the wall, and yeah, my self-worth was really low, and I just couldn't make anything. And it seemed meaningless, you know, things just making art seemed so meaningless after that storm, you know, because it sort of felt like if I stopped doing the work that I'm doing right now, no one would notice but me.
Yeah.
And that was a really hard thing. I mean, that was just such a hard thing to contend with. And then basically what happened was I started to understand, okay, if something is important to me, then it's important. And it's as simple as that.
Mm.
And the more I kind of told myself that, the easier it was for me to get back on track and get in the studio and do it.
Where did that come from? Where did that sentiment come from?
I think it just came out of sheer desperation, because what was I going to do? Just never make stuff again? I mean, I needed to, there had to be some sort of language, like some sort of little pep talk or kind of mantra I could tell myself to get back and just attempt, you know, attempt to make stuff. And then when I started to, you know, when I started to feel a little more momentum in the studio and my creative output was starting to chug along a little bit, everything that I was making was complete garbage, but I didn't care because I was making it. It felt really good, you know?
Yeah. I hear you. There's usually some, I would imagine that there's some kind of turning point, you know, where you go from mourning, grieving, mm-hmm. you know, and being mm-hmm. depressed, to some kind of spark that gets you to realize that if it matters to me, it matters. You know what I mean? You don't just,
yeah.
you don't sit in the bottom of the grieving or depression ocean and then all of a sudden, you know, give yourself a pep talk. You know what I mean? So there had to be something, and maybe it was meeting your now wife, maybe it was something else like that, that turned you around. And that's why, kind of what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to imply that it was sudden, because like I said, I think it was about 2.5 years where I didn't make anything.
Right.
And I was not a productive working artist in any way. So
So it's not like this was like a quick turnaround. I think if there is a genesis that like is the thing that lit a fire under my ass, you're going to have to ask my therapist.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't know that I can point to a specific moment
right.
where it was like, oh, okay, I'm okay now. I can do this again. I don't know what that moment was. So I know that there's a genesis of the reason why I didn't make anything, but I don't know what the genesis is for me being able to make things again.
Did you run into...
All I know is that I had to have a lot of conversations about it.
Right. Got it. Did you happen to have conversations with anybody else who threw Sandy and, you know, or perhaps something else were also, you know, in blocks or were grieving because of work destroyed or anything along those lines, who also maybe couldn't make anything?
No, I didn't. I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I know that those people exist. I went to a couple forums where it was about like how to recoup losses from the hurricane that were like hosted by different cultural organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the people had lost, like they were trying to recoup personal items, and it's a lot harder when you're trying to recoup the loss of intellectual property because the value I don't have at that point. Now I can a little bit better, but at that point, you know, I was 29 years old and I was straight out of grad school, so I didn't have a lot of proof of what the value of my work is. Fortunately, there's an organization called NYFA here in New York. Have you heard of that?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they offered grants to people whose work was damaged in Sandy, and you could get up to $5,000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to apply and tell them, like, this is how much I lost. You had to send them photographic evidence and all that stuff. And they gave me the full $5,000 because I got hit so hard. And I can't even tell you what that meant. I've even, like, written emails to their customer HR, whatever, customer service, in like, you know, after the fact, years afterwards, thanking them again, because that was just, I could use that and I could send my hard drives to these like high tech people that do all this magic and recover hard drives. So at least I was able to recover some scans of old negatives and all that stuff, but everything else was gone. I mean, it was a miracle. I actually found my grandmother's wedding ring. It was in a box, in a box, in a box, in a box. So imagine like all this disgusting wet paper slopped around in this little teeny tiny ring kind of glinting, and I was able to dig it out. So that was wonderful, and the NYFA thing was great. But otherwise, everyone that I told, I just always fucking hated their reaction so much. Like I told this one guy, and he's like, oh, that really sucks. One time, like I had my favorite guitar got stolen. And I was just so... No one could respond. No one could say the right thing because
yeah.
I was so angry and sad.
Yeah.
So, you know, unfortunately, not only did I not really talk to anyone who had the same experience as me, but also I don't think I would have even been capable of having a very productive conversation about it in the wake of the storm because it was just so awful.
Yeah. Well, I think that's great that you got that NYFA. New York Foundation for the Arts, by the way, I want to mention for people listening, grant. And that maybe that was a big, you know, I know you said that it was, you did a lot of talking in therapy about things and that helped turn things around. But I think that was obviously, I would imagine, a pretty big factor in turning around. And I also wanted to say that ring in a, you know, in multiple layers of boxes amidst all of that debris and waterlog. Sounds very sculptural. Sounds like the genesis for a sculpture, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of does. It does a little bit. You know, I have some friends who are so good at paying attention to environmental factors that impact their work. And I think that that's an area of my life that I can improve upon, just paying closer attention. Because I'm sure if I really kind of mine the way I was feeling and kind of the procedures I was going through and trying to kind of rebuild after this loss, I would probably find a lot of gems in there that have led me to where I am right now. But I think I was kind of on autopilot a little bit, just trying to get back to feeling like myself. So
sure.
I don't think I was paying attention.
Right.
You
That's
know?
Understandable. Yeah.
It is. I do think that it's meaningful that I felt like my life was really easily washed away. And then now I end up, you know, X amount of years later, renovating a giant building. I think that that probably has some, I could definitely read into that.
What would you, if you, I don't know if you have, I don't want to put you on the spot, but what would you say to people who, like many of us artists, have work that's being held onto, being stored, you know, in not the most glamorous or dignified circumstances? You know, they're not being stored in crates in the archive section of a fancy gallery, but rather are maybe gathering dust in the, you know, on the edges of a garage or something like that. You know, having been through that experience, do you feel like you have any insights to people to share in that regard?
I don't know that I do. I know that for me, if I find that I'm storing a piece and it's been hanging around the studio for a long time and I'm not super thrilled about showing it or anything like that, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, is this work, do I need to live with this work the rest of my life? Because
right.
I think it's really easy to get buried underneath your work, especially
yeah.
if you make large work, or,
yeah.
you know, if your paintings are enormous and they're on boards, or if you make sculptures and they're these massive, cumbersome things, you could easily bury yourself in that stuff. So I don't know that I have any words of wisdom. I just know that for myself, and this also might have to do with the storm, I have no problem throwing things away. I really don't. I mean, one thing leads to another in the studio, and if it doesn't sell, if it doesn't go live in the world, if it never gets shown, and if I don't think that it's invaluable in terms of like understanding my own history and lineage as an artist, I'll toss it.
Mm.
I really will.
Mm-hmm.
No problem at all. There's been times that my wife will see me taking something out of the garbage and she'll be like, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this?" And I said, "Because I don't want to be buried under my work. I want to love my work and feel capable of moving around in the world. I don't want to be stuck with it and have it be an albatross." So
yeah.
Well, maybe that happened from the storm. It's
yeah,
distinctly possible.
Definitely. That's a nice result, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
So,
I never thought about it till now. So thanks for...
Yeah, of course.
I think you led me there. Good
well,
job.
Yeah, hey, a little therapy, you know, that's not such a bad thing.
Right.
It's a practical thing.
This is a very long therapy session. You're going to make a lot of money off this.
Right, right. Well, you know, if we had started, you know, with the flood, yeah, this would have been a long therapy session. But we talked a lot about your project as well. And by the way, since we have been away from there for a while, is there anything about the project that I didn't ask or that we didn't cover as early as it is still that you feel we would be remiss if we didn't mention the moment?
No, I mean, I think you asked really good questions. I hope that I was able to answer them clearly. I'm very excited about it, and I hope that my enthusiasm comes through because I think it's going to be a great thing for the region, and I think it's going to be a great thing for the village.
Yeah, no, I think your enthusiasm does come through, and indeed,
good.
If this podcast is still around in 18 to 20 months, let's reconnect and we'll see how things are going.
Fantastic. That's great.
Excellent. Steph, you've been great to talk to. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Michael. I had a good time.
Good. And we're out. All right. Fantastic.
All right.
Thank you so much again to Steph for talking to me. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Found that incredibly illuminating. And before I get to a quick reminder about the P-word t-shirts, as well as the 20 most powerless people in the Art World 2017 edition, wanted to give a big thanks to those of you who are continuing to support the show on Patreon, where one can support the show on a monthly basis for as little as $1 a month. You might want to check that out via theconversationpod.com/support. I also want to give a big thank you to my most recent donator, listener Andy Davis, who listens in his studio in Des Moines, Iowa, and rarely enough, splits his time between there and France, where he was about to jump off to when he donated to the show. So hopefully that encourages the rest of you guys listening in your studio and elsewhere to contribute to the show financially. We don't have any advertising this week, as you may have noticed. So your financial contributions are greatly appreciated and even necessary. So you can support the show financially via Patreon for as little as $1 a month, or $3 a month will get you the bonus episodes, Undying Love from Me, and more. Or you can do a one-time donation of $25 or more via PayPal. Both of those are on the conversationpod.com/support page. Of course, you can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast. You can also spread the word about the show via word of mouth. It's much appreciated. And leaving a nice review on iTunes, the Apple platform, that seems to generate the greatest amount of downloads. So I guess that's the place to start. You could also do it on Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get this podcast. Thank you very much for doing that in advance. And before we get to the 20 most powerless people in the art world 2017, the P-word t-shirt that Patrick Kamut of high school art fame in Pittsburgh, an artist, developed with me. We did one round of those. We'd like to do another round. There are about 5 t-shirt orders awaiting your support. That is you to join them. We want to have about 20. So again, for you, those of you not familiar, you can go check it out on the support page of the website as well. But it's basically PR, expletive symbols, ICE, something like that is what the t-shirt is. And it's got the logo of the podcast on the back. You could just do a t-shirt with just the logo on the back, or you could do a t-shirt with just the P word on the front as well. Those are both options, and they come in 4 colors. They come in a couple of different thicknesses. They come in all the sizes that you could possibly need. So that's the t-shirt situation. So we need to get a good fit 10, 15 more orders to make that next production happen. And thank you very much to Patrick again for his support of the show in that way. All right, so highlights from the 20 most powerless people in the art world 2017. I just wanted to read and maybe comment on some of my favorite standouts. So number 2, adjunct professors. It goes, if there were serfdom in academia, it would resemble the itinerant lives of adjunct professors. And if you missed it, The Guardian had a harrowing piece about adjuncts who are sleeping in cars or turning to sex work to make ends meet. Many of us know these scenarios are far too familiar, since every adjunct we've ever met is expected to perform miracles for a few thousand dollars. It's not a sustainable system. Wow, I actually have not been hearing about teachers who are sleeping in their cars or turning to sex work. Have you? I'd be interested to know if that's something that you're familiar with, or if you are one of those people, do reach out to us. Number 8, artists in precarious housing. From Beijing to Brooklyn, artists are feeling the crunch. In Beijing, authorities used the tragic fire, just like they did in the Bay Area with the ghost ship building, as a pretext to crack down on illegal structures, which often means places where people on the margins of society, including many artists, live or work. The only thing that may change this continuing crisis is grassroots activism followed by regulation. Are we there yet? Probably not, but there are signs that activists may be getting smarter at tackling the problem. Okay, maybe. Number 9, Mikes Pop. Should I try that again? Mikes Pop. Try not to pop it too hard. This Belgian artist couldn't free himself from a block of marble. That's just sad. It's not exactly a metaphor, but it's also kind of funny, like a drunk bet gone awry. Our favorite part was that it was part of an exhibition titled The Raft. Art is, in parentheses, not lonely. And we have no idea why it is titled that way, other than to be pretentious. We honestly can't believe this isn't a Portlandia sketch. Bravo, Pop. By the way, an upcoming guest and I will be talking about pretentiousness and pretentious, so stay tuned for that. Number 11, Derek Grinnell and Ernest Lee. These two artists don't know each other, but many will relate to their fates. Grinnell had his car stolen, and with it, all his art. Quote, I feel terrible. I mean, my life's gone, my life's work, and a lot of my life's achievements are all gone, he told KCRW. Then Lee had his mobile art studio stolen. They may not be well-known artists with national name recognition, but it's important to acknowledge that artists everywhere constantly face setbacks like this. Thankfully, people are starting to support artists in their communities, and Lee received over $7,000 in donations. Then again, we all know money will never replace lost art and journals. Okay, that is an example of why the conversation did not make the 20 most powerless people list. Got to have a little bit more tragedy, if not drama, in your life, and just being a struggling podcast is not going to cut it. Okay, 15. People waiting in Kusama mirror room lines. What the hell is happening? This year, galleries and museums in three cities, Los Angeles, yes, us, Washington, D.C., and New York, had epic queues for Yayoi Kusama's Infinity Mirror Rooms. Surely there's a better way to do this. Maybe Tokyo's new Kusama Museum is onto something. But in the Instagram-crazed culture we live in, Kusama fever isn't dying down anytime soon. I would love to hear from you if you waited in a Kusama line in one of those three cities. I still have not seen the Kusama show here in L.A., and I'm running out of time. I believe there's maybe a week left or so. So, Chris, should I go see it? Number 19, Fyodor Pavlov Andreevich. The Russian performance artist scored a viral hit when he crashed the Met Gala by arriving nude in a clear plexiglass box. But that also made him much easier to haul away and arrest, which is exactly what the NYPD did. Not exactly a stellar red carpet debut. I thought that was an amusing image. And then who could leave out the honorable mentions where it's all at in this powerless list? Vito Schnabel, a name that part of which might be familiar to you. We couldn't resist having some fun with Schnabel's arrest for shrooms at Burning Man. That's like someone getting arrested for drinking in public on Bourbon Street. What a story. We hope it becomes a movie, and we hear he knows people who know people that can make that happen. Fingers crossed. And perhaps the ultimate in powerless people. Here it comes. Ready? Collectors. There's always someone richer and more connected than you and can buy whatever they want, and that must sting. Ouch. Okay, they aren't that powerless, but we couldn't resist. Good one, Hyperallergic. All right. All right, so those are my choices among the powerless list. You should maybe check out the whole thing, but I think those highlights will tide you over. Hope you enjoyed those. I hope you enjoyed the show overall. And again, happy 2018. Godspeed to all of us, as it were, if you will. Thank you very much for listening to the show, and I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.